stocks, bonds, ETFs, straight out of downtown Chicago. This is Zach's Market Edge.
Welcome to Zach's Market Edge, the podcast about investing in your life. I'm your host, Tracy Reinick, and this week I'm joined by John Blank, Zach's chief equity strategist, who also just happens to have a PhD in economics. And I bring that up because he thinks like they think, they being the Fed, and they're all a bunch of economists. They're not like the other people. So they look at the data and we're going to too. So today we're going to discuss the U.S. economy. Where is it heading? Is there a recession? Is there not a recession? Why is the Fed, you know, seemingly doing what they're doing, not, you know, pausing everything, although we don't know for sure what they're going to do. And we have John here to tell us all about it. So welcome, John.
Thanks, Tracy.
Okay, so let's get right to it, because I know you are a bull about this year and the U.S. economy. So let's start off there. How could that be?
Well, Tracy, I want to give everybody out there who's listening to this a web link. Go to Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta on what's called GDP Now. Now, what's interesting about GDP Now is this is the guy down in Atlanta that does this growth rate for the U.S. economy. So his latest forecast here, and I'm quoting it from February the 17th, says that for the first quarter of 2015, given all the indicators that have come in to date to February 17th, the GDP growth rate in the first quarter of 2016 is now at 2.6%, down from 2.7% in 2012, in February 12th. 2.6% is not a recession economy, Tracy.
No, that's pretty good.
It's very good. It's very muddled through, and that 0.8% that we saw in the fourth quarter is going to be old news. It's already old news, and all of this is coming, lo and behold, from the falling oil price because it lowers our imports, which raises our growth rate.
Okay, so some of the manufacturing data, however, has been, you know, pretty weak. We got like Empire Manufacturing that's been in the negative. The Philly manufacturing has been the negative. Chicago PMI has been kind of up and down. It was a little bit better last month, which looks better. So what do we make about the manufacturing? Or should we not care because it's, you know, now only about 10% of the economy? Or what? Where does that fit in? Because I think a lot of the people who are bearish look at that manufacturing data and say, uh-oh, we're in trouble.
Well, you know, clearly it's the worthy discussion to have. And what you need to understand about purchasing manager indexes as a leading indicator of the economy is they are, first and foremost, purchasing manager indexes. They are not indexes of the U.S. economy. You are making that leap, and in most cases, making that leap makes a lot of sense. However, in this circumstance, the purchasing manager index is actually telling you how they will behave in the face of collapsing prices for purchasing. And that this has confused a lot of the bears. If you go into the purchasing manager indexes, the sub-index that's driving the 50 sub-50 readings, which is scaring everybody, are coming from a price sub-index at 33 or 32 month over month, because when you're a purchasing manager, you get paid to purchase at the right time. So you hold off, and you won't purchase until the price is stabilized. So what we're seeing here is very rational behavior by a set of actors being telegraphed through the purchasing manager index. Now, why I am not bearish because I've looked at all these things is because the sub-indexes for production and new orders are actually above 50, which are the ones that matter for the U.S. economy.
Yeah, I know that those areas have been rebounding, at least in the Chicago PMI. And I've seen in the chemical sector the very behavior you are saying, especially, you know, as these crude prices come down, so many chemicals are crude-based and, you know, have the petroleum ingredients in there that it makes no sense, as you said, for the purchasers when they know that the prices are going to be lowered because crude keeps going down. They are going to hold off as long as possible, obviously, to get the lower price.
Absolutely. And you're seeing this also in the inventory accounts for the GDP. I mean, again, to get the lower prices with strong dollars with manufacturing, you also got to shop abroad. So now you have another issue that's baked into the purchasing manager index is you've got to draw down your domestic stockpiles, and you have to draw up your foreign stockpile. So there's another issue that conflates here, which is that inventory sub-indexes are very confusing when you're playing this game.
Yeah. Let's also talk about like the jobless claims and what's going on with unemployment, because that looks really strong right now. I mean, we're at 4.9 on unemployment as of last month. And then the jobless claims, I was shocked last week when they dropped again back to like 262,000, which was the lowest since last November. Even with the problems going on in manufacturing and in the energy side, there have been a lot of layoffs now. I think I saw a stat that said through 2015, there was maybe about 200,000 layoffs in the energy sector. So that's nothing to sneeze at. But how can we have this, you know, unemployment claims this low, and we have all these stresses in the energy side? Is the U.S. economy just so strong in other areas that it's countering that?
Absolutely. If you go to the GDP accounts, real GDP accounts, quarter by quarter of the last 5 years, you're going to notice that the amount of spending at the macroeconomic level for oil and gas is 1.7% on average, 1.7%. So the point is whether GDP, then GDP tells the story, is whether oil is priced at 90 or 10 or 0, it's only going to dent 1.7% of the U.S. economy, even if it disappeared. It's just not the same magnitude. So you get the housing crisis, 2008. Well, that's 12%. Infotech, that's 8 or 9%. This is not in that camp. And there is literally, mathematically, Tracy, there is no way to turn this thing into a recession, because the other thing is you don't lose that spending when the price goes down. You gain it in other parts of the accounting framework. Unlike housing and unlike Infotech, there is a quid pro quo on the spending. It's a substitution away from oil into other products that is actually relevant here, and that's what we're seeing in these other sectors.
Yeah, we've talked about that with the low gas prices, especially, you know, here in the office. We're all still in awe at what the gasoline price is here in Chicago, because we're normally historically really high, kind of like you guys out in L.A. We always pay more. We're always paying at the pump. But I just saw it was down to $1.68 here in the city, which has a lot of taxes and things that always push it higher. And that is incredibly low. And I know I'm saving money at the pump, so it's going somewhere. We've been lamenting for the last year, like, we're not seeing anything from the lower gas prices, but I definitely think we are now. I mean, you're noticing $50, $70, maybe even $100 a month extra in your pocket.
Absolutely. And those magnitudes are going to start piling up. I mean, again, the disconnect here is flows in stocks. I mean, as an economist, what you care about is the flow rate of income into spending. And the problem here is you can take that extra $100 and build up your stock of savings for a while until you and manage out the flows. So what I've seen from JP Morgan is that people are basically spending 70, 90 cents of this extra income. So we're getting it. It's happening.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions about, can the economy, you've already said it can sustain, even if we see a real severe downturn in areas like Dallas or Houston. Obviously, the Dakotas are not doing well now. And then there's going to be pockets of other areas that were heavily dependent on the oil sector and just mining, even in general, that's not doing well either. But I mean, you're saying that it won't really, not that it won't matter, but we have a vibrant economy in these other areas that can, overtake what's happening in Texas, for instance.
Right, exactly. I mean, the issue I've explained to people is the difference between statistics, regional statistics in particular, and industry statistics versus summary statistics of the U.S. economy. Because it's really, if we're talking recession, there is a definition of a recession, which is consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth, or several months equivalent of negative job growth. So right now we have 2.5% and 0.8% in GDP growth, so there's absolutely no way we can go into recession until the fourth quarter of this year at earliest. And the job growth that is correspondent with this, as you point out with the claims, is also very strong, indicating we're doing plus 200 a month right now, not even close to 100,
right.
Not 100 versus zero. And we got to get below zero, Tracy, before recession happens. And we have to get below zero for months. These things don't surprise you. They don't creep up on you.
Okay, that's good to know, because I always get this feeling everybody thinks it is creeping up. Like, we're really in a recession right now. We just don't know. And they're all, like, secretive about it. We're in one.
But exactly. We're not. What's happened in '08 is, and The Big Short is helping it along, is you get the genius who called the turn and the person who saw it all. Now, again, in that period, 07, prior to the collapse that was driven by the government's tawdry policies towards housing and the CDOs, prior to that, you did have 7 or 8 months of negative job growth in 2007. So all you had to know before the crisis, before the collapse, before anything that happened with Henry Paulson and the Treasury and all the other madness, is there was signals from the job market for multiple months that there was a recession going on.
Okay, so this year I need to basically keep an eye out on the jobs market. If that starts to tumble, but significantly tumble, not, you know, 200,000 a month to 150, but significantly lower, then that's the red flag.
Right. Month on month in a final fashion, you don't have to be the genius, final monthly job counts. So you read the revised job counts going back 2-3 months. When you tag 2 or 3 months in a row of negative, and I mean negative, not low positive, negative job growth, get out, that's a recession.
Okay, so...
it's not that complicated.
No, I know. That's why I wanted to, you know, discuss this, because I just keep hearing all the people saying, oh no, we're in one, we're doomed. But let's talk about the stock market. Could that, I mean, we had a pretty nasty pullback in January and, you know, into middle part of February so far. If that were to continue, if we were to see further selling, could that bring us into a recession?
It's the way you get a stock market pullback to turn into a recession. If you look at the data of the two big ones in 2001 and 2007, you'd have to have a pullback of 30 to 40%. Because the way it works is it's a 20-to-1 ratio of stock wealth to consumer blowouts. So basically, if you want to take a 2% growth rate economy like the U.S. down below zero, you need to have a 40% blowout in stocks. So 10% is going to give you a half a point off your consumer growth rate. By the way, you're building up probably half a percent from the oil gas, thanks to it's probably net neutral. So it's the magnitude of the stock collapse that matters, and the magnitude that really matters is at least 30% and probably 40% of a stock collapse, which in this context, 40% of 2,100 is, you know, 1,400, 1,300 on the S&P.
Yeah, that's a pretty major event there.
Yeah, if we get to 1,300 on the S&P, yes, we're in recession.
Okay. But we're not there yet, so let's talk about some other positive things. What about, some mortgage rates have come down, and they spiked down last week, and they did bounce back up a little bit, but they were still near those record lows from a couple of years ago. Could we see, refis and all of that add another stimulus to the economy as well?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about negative rates out there outside the United States is that what they're doing is they're rendering irrelevant the short-term policy rate thinking at the Fed. And so what's happening is what a negative rate is, and we have in Sweden, we have in Switzerland, we have in the EU, we have in Japan, is it's not a negative rate outside the central bank. It's a negative rate inside the central bank. So what happened is I parked trillions of dollars of reserves in the central bank. And if you charge me for it, effectively, I go, well, that's not great. So I move those reserves into the bank I'm managing. Now, what happens when I move them out of the central bank into the bank, once I'm supposed to go out and lend them to all the companies that are in my area. But what has happened is everybody who has this extra money is finding it that you can put it to work in U.S. Treasuries as long as you're making even 0.5%. It's better than nothing. So
right.
What's happening is the deep and liquid market, and there's only one, which is the U.S. Treasuries, is sinking, not because it's telegraphing a collapse of the U.S. economy, because where else can I park that money I can no longer park in my central bank? So the point is, we have a 1.7, 1.8 Treasury. It can get to 1.
Wow.
And as you point out, that is a benefit to the U.S. stock market, to the U.S. housing market, and to U.S. consumers generally.
Well, yeah. I mean, everybody's refinancing everything they have a loan on if it goes down that low.
Right. And again, it's going to send perverse signal that all the bears are going to point out to it. They're going to say, John, yeah, the interest rates are collapsing. I'm going to say, yes, generally speaking, if in lieu of no negative rate policies, this would be a tell. But yeah, much like the purchasing energy index, what it's telling us is that negative rate policies are seeing this effect and into the Treasury market. And again, you have to stop and ask yourself, what is happening at the nexus of the change, at the nexus of the purchasing matter, at the nexus of the central bank and its bank? These are where the issues get drawn, and then once you step back from that, think through in a new way, in a clean way, what is really happening to the U.S. and global economy.
Okay, that's a good way to look at it. And I think people, you know, need to keep an open mind about what's going on out there right now.
Right, because history in the face of all this heterodox policy, and history in the face of history, with 98 being the last time we saw an Asian financial crisis, a big collapse in currencies and in oil at $10, show you that both reading history correctly, that there are corrections without recessions, and this is typically what happens with oil price recessions and currency collapses that we've already seen, and also understanding that just taking the blanket tells, the ISM manufacturing tell, and all of this stuff about rate tells and term structure tells, isn't going to work when you've bent the system as far as we have with all of this other activity. Saudis, central banking, these people, like I tell people all the time, remind yourself that you live in an aquarium, not the open sea. This is an entirely managed situation, and it is becoming an effective policymakers, whether it's OPEC, whether it's the Saudis, whether it's Japan, the EU. These people have an effect, and it is not an open ocean. You're not out there swimming, waiting for the next big surf. It doesn't happen that way.
Yeah. So if, you know, the economy is doing pretty good right now and you're fairly bullish, what kind of stocks are you interested in? What kind of stock picks do you have?
Well, Tracy, I like a stock like Sherwin-Williams, which has 40% oil-based products that's driving up on housing. There you got a clean double.
SHW, I think is their ticker.
Yeah. Yeah, so Sherwin-Williams is a great stock. Or consider like a Casey's General Stores, ticker CASY, which is the exact number one ranked stock. Here you got, you know, general stores right next to the gas pumps. So a guy makes $20 extra at the gas pump. He goes buys a drink or some chips or a sandwich for a pizza. And this company is killing it. And
it is.
The stock's still pretty well valued.
Have you ever been to a Casey's, John?
You know, I was in one, back at Christmas time up in Minnesota when I visited my brother. Yeah, they're big. They're basically what they are. They are a general store. They have just they're not more than a convenience store. They have all the stuff that a modest 500 or 5,000 person town would need.
Right.
So they're basically taking over a little niche that used to be filled by the general stores.
Have you ever had their pizza?
Yeah, it's good, man. They make fresh pizza.
They do, yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't had their pizza. I've only filled up gas in one of their, you know, just at the gas station there. But apparently they're the fifth largest pizza chain in the United States. I didn't even realize.
Yeah, they like, you know, the Allegiant Air's, and a lot of businesses are finding that, you know, as these big chain stores pull into only the big demographics that roll up on the spreadsheets, that they leave these middle-sized and small towns full, and it's a big, big area. It's much urban as we are. We still have a third, 30, 40% of the people living in towns below 50 or 100,000 people, and these are where the Casey's General... You remember, and that means these are the people that drive a lot. These are the people that move around a lot.
That's true. Yeah, and now they're benefiting from that low, definitely from that low gas price.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, you're getting a distribution back into these areas where driving... is really important, and people are in their cars a lot, and that's certainly these areas.
Yeah, I like the similar consumer-based names that you just mentioned. I'm going a little bit more on the home side for my picks. I like Williams and Sonoma still. I mentioned them at the very beginning of the year when on the podcast we did a bullish or bearish type of podcast. And I said I liked Williams-Sonoma as long as we didn't enter a recession. And now that so far we're not going into a recession, I still like them. The shares have really gotten beat up bad in the sell-off, so I like them even more now. They're trading only about 15 times, but they do pay a dividend, 2.5%, so you got that going. They haven't reported yet, so it's unclear, you know, how their brands are doing. They struggled a little bit in 2015 at, you know, it's just kind of consumer preferences, but their West Elm brand is what I really like. That's the modern furniture, and that's just been killing it. So I still like Williams & Sonoma here. And then Home Depot, they just reported on the day that we recorded this, on February 23rd, and they just killed it. I couldn't even believe their U.S. same-store sales were up 8.9%, and then total same-store sales up 7.1%. And that 7.1% number includes Canada. And I didn't listen to the conference call, so I'm not sure what the analysts were able to get out of management on who's doing what where. But Canada should be not good. Unfortunately for them, they are getting hit much more by the energy and commodities downturn, and big parts of Canada are in recession now. So I have a feeling those numbers weren't that good, but I think Mexico was doing really well for them. They said they were going to open up 5 more stores in Mexico in 2016. So I feel like that's maybe countering what's going up in Canada. But they raised their dividend 17%. So they're one of the few companies actually raising their dividend this year. And things just look real good for Home Depot. If you kind of want to play that whole area and then also the home builders, I kind of don't like the home builders as just like the separate unit because I still don't trust what they're doing. But you can buy the home builder ETF, the XHB, and that ETF includes both the home builders, which is about 30% of it, but also the building products, including Sherwin-Williams, which you just mentioned, John. And then also like Masco, which makes kitchen cabinets and faucets, and Fortune Brands Homes and Security. They also do cabinets. They have Lowe's and Home Depot in there. They also have Williams and Sonoma. And then Whirlpool is also in there. So if you want kind of the everything, go for the XHB. But I do think the consumer is spending right here. I know everybody's doom and gloom about the consumer and they think, you know, oh, it's over. They're not going to be out there buying. But I just don't see it. Like the auto sales are still strong. Whirlpool reported really great appliance sales and said that demand starting this year was good.
Yeah, well, Tracy, you know, I went to Home Depot back at Christmas time, and I'm almost certain I was the only economist at Home Depot.
You might have been.
Right. I mean, the bottom line is people are people, and they if there's income in their pocket and they're doing their
they're
life, they can care less what happens to the stock market, the economy.
Right, that's right. And, you know, housing is still hanging in there. Housing prices have recovered. People are able to take those home equity loans again. And they're feeling good. And they want to remodel and get some new appliances in there. They're tired of, you know, the 15-year-old refrigerator, I guess. And they want the new car, too.
Yeah, we're seeing it all across the board. When you've had a, you know, the thing you got to remember is a lot of pressure is coming off of households, not just people. When you get extra jobs, it's a lot of it's your teenager son getting a job, your wife getting a little extra income, you earning a bonus. So these kinds of things, from a household perspective, are very bullish and have the multiplier effects into this discretionary areas. Because it is sometimes just discretionary. Finally, there's an extra job in the house. Your son's got a job working down at you know, Dunkin' Donuts or whatever, and these things happen. So they don't happen when things are at a 7 or 8% unemployment rate and everybody's hunkered down and relying on the primary income.
That's right. That's a good point. Well, this is really good. I think, you know, the bullish case needs to be told out there, and people should be paying more attention to it so they don't miss out on some good investing opportunities here. But I might have to have on someone who's bearish just to hear what their side is saying, just to be equal. But I am a bull as well, so this was easy for me to talk about. So we'll just have to see. We'll have to have you on in a couple months and see kind of where we stand then.
Absolutely. That's the other point is we need to get out into with green leaves on the trees and see what happens.
Oh, yeah. We're waiting here. We're supposed to get more snow here in Chicago, so we're ready for spring. And I do think that's going to drive, you know, even more on the consumer side.
I agree with you.
Okay. So if you want to catch any of our articles, you can definitely check out John's articles on Zacks.com and mine as well. And you can also listen to our other podcasts. We have a lot of interesting commentary on a lot of those podcasts on SoundCloud.com and also on iTunes. So until next week. Oh, wait, I was going to give some of the tickers just in case you didn't get the tickers. Sherwin-Williams, SHW, Casey's General Stores, CASY. We had the Home Builders ETF, XHB. Williams & Sonoma is WSM. And then Home Depot is, of course, HD. So I'll see you next week.